super friends. My name is Neil and welcome to this episode 102 of the Get Your Comic Con podcast. We're here fortnightly-ish to bring you a slice of film, TV and pop culture goodness from our studio direct to your listening device. Or as it is, you could be watching us now on YouTube. Thank you to everyone who tuned in 2 weeks ago for episode 101, which was the first time I attempted to record myself fumbling through this podcast, and you seem to enjoy it. So I'm back again, sweating. Unfortunately, we're in the middle of a heatwave here in London. It is 32 degrees for about the fourth day in a row. So if there is background noise, I apologise. There is a fan. There is a lot going on outside. I can't shut the window. It is just too hot. I am going to die. But that aside, we are back. And this episode, I am going to be wrapping up some of the latest headlines from across the worlds of film, TV, comic books, etc., etc. And I've got two TV shows to talk to you about. First up is the return of Star Trek Lower Decks, which returned with two episodes last week on Paramount Plus. You can now stream both episodes 1 and 2 of Season 4 and new episodes weekly for the next few weeks thereafter. And I'm also going to be talking about The Morning Show. The Apple TV series returns today for Season 3 with two brand new episodes. I've been able to watch all 10 episodes of the season, so I'm going to be chatting to you a bit about that. The embargo has literally just lifted as I am posting this, so it's going to be a spoiler light review because obviously I have seen the whole season and I do not want to ruin it for you because it's very, very exciting. So without further ado, let's dive into the news. Friday just gone, September the 8th, was Star Trek Day. It's the annual celebration of when the pilot episode of the original series first aired on screens across the US. And this year was a very special anniversary, as it also doubled up as the 50th anniversary of Star Trek the Animated Series. Now, if you don't know what that is, firstly, shame on you. But secondly, I'm happy to explain it to you. So, several years after the end of Star Trek Season 3, William Shatner, Nichelle Nichols, Leonard Nimoy, and the whole crew reunited for a Saturday morning cartoon, which was the very first animated venture in the Star Trek universe. Since then, there have been Short Treks, the brand new Very Short Treks, the wonderful Star Trek Prodigy, and also Star Trek Lower Decks. So this year's Star Trek Day was a celebration of all things animated in the world of Star Trek. But there was also an exciting announcement. So, brand Star Trek is collaborating with Grammy Award-winning artist Kid Cudi on a brand new, multi-platform collaboration, which is being called Boldly Be. So the collaboration includes Kid Cudi's unique lens on music with an original song which is inspired by Star Trek, an interactive gaming component, we don't know any more on that just yet, and also a bold fashion collaboration that will launch in October of 2023. Now, if, like me, you only listen to Kerrang! Radio and heavy metal, you probably do not know who Kid Cudi is. So, thankfully the press release helped me out. Scott Mascudi, better known as stage name Kid Cudi, is an American actor, Grammy award-winning musician and multi-platform recording artist from Cleveland, Ohio. Cudi first debuted his music on the scene in 2008 and quickly rose to the top of the Billboard charts. His first studio album, Man on the Moon, The End of Days, received widespread industry praise and set the stage for his subsequent successful endeavours. Over the course of his musical career, Cudi has made exceptional contributions to the music industry, and many prominent artists claim his discography as a significant source of stylistic inspiration. As of 2022, he's released 10 studio albums. How do I not know who this is? And has sold over 22 million records. His most recent album, Enter Galactic, released in September 2022, in tandem with companion Emmy-nominated Netflix animated project. His next highly anticipated album, Insano, will be released in 2024. There's a quote from him as well, which says, "I grew up watching Star Trek with my dad, who single-handedly is responsible for turning me into a fan. The most important thing to me is to be as authentic as possible. Star Trek's mission has always been about having a hopeful future, and when I was first approached about this project, it was the perfect marriage of all the things that I believe in. Being brave and a hero by doing what's right and fighting for freedom, I can't wait to share my love of this incredible franchise with the world." Boldly Be takes inspiration from Trek's ethos of IDIC, infinite diversity in infinite combinations, the basis of Vulcan philosophy, the vast variables create truth, beauty, and strength. And following his kickoff, Boldly Be, StarTrek.com invites fans around the world to celebrate their own selves by sharing their boldest moments and collaborating on stories and visuals that represent Trek's enduring message of hope, authenticity, discovery, and more. That was really difficult to say. I'm taking a swig of tea. There is a teaser So we don't know, we haven't really seen any of the products from this yet, but there is a teaser video which you can check out over on our website, which is www.getyourcomiccon.co.uk. You can also see that across social media. Now, it's hard to believe, but next year, 2024, Batman 89, the film that turned me into a comic book geek, the Tim Burton classic, is turning 35. That makes me feel very, very old. So with the 35th anniversary, it's now been confirmed that Batman 89 will be the next of the DC Films in Concert tour series. So you might remember earlier this year, I went to watch the brilliant The Batman, directed by Matt Reeves and starring Robert Pattinson, played with a full orchestra at the Eventim Apollo here in Hammersmith, London. And now we know that the next of these films to take place in this series will be Batman 89. The tour kicks off in LA on January the 13th, 2024, travels around the US, and eventually makes its way to London at the Barbican Centre on May the 26th, 2024. If you want to see all of the tour dates, then you can check them out over on our website. And tickets for the London dates, there is a pre-sale which kicks off on September the 14th. If you sign up to the mailing list, you can get a code to be in with a chance of getting tickets in pre-sale, and then we'll go on general sale shortly after that. So in case you haven't been to one of these before, essentially what you get is a huge screen in a concert venue which will project the film. You will watch the film as normal, all the dialogue, sound effects, everything is there. But there is also a live orchestra sitting underneath that that will then play, in this case, Danny Elfman's absolutely legendary score to that film. So if you can imagine hearing that theme live, it, as a Batman fan, is just amazing. So we're going to get the opportunity to see the... I've only seen snippets, actually. So I've been to the Tim Burton, Danny Elfman celebration concert before. I've been to superhero and film concerts before. But I have never had the entire score of 89 played by an orchestra in front of me. So I am incredibly excited. I cannot wait. May 26th cannot come around fast enough. Again, if you want to get all the details and the links to where you can buy tickets, head over to our website, www.getyourcomiccon.co.uk. And finally, in the news this week, Apple TV has finally released a teaser trailer for the upcoming Monarch Legacy of Monsters TV series. So this is the series which is set in the Monsterverse, which you will know as Legendary Pictures' so far four movie series: Godzilla, Kong, Skull Island, Godzilla King of the Monsters, and Godzilla vs. Kong, now to be Godzilla X Kong in 2024. So this is a brand new 10-episode series which will premiere globally on Friday, November the 17th with two episodes, and will then run through till Friday, January the 12th, when its season finale will air. It stars Kurt Russell, Wyatt Russell, Anna Sawai, Kiersey Clemons, Ren Watabi, Marie Yamamoto, Anders Holm, Joe Tippett, and Eliza Lazowski. There's also a teaser poster which you can check out over on our website. But the synopsis for the series reads, following the thunderous battle between Godzilla and the Titans, so that's Godzilla King of the Monsters, that leveled San Francisco and the shocking revelation that monsters are real, Monarch Legacy of Monsters tracks two siblings following in their father's footsteps to uncover their family's connection to the secretive organization known as Monarch. So that is a company who you've seen running through each of the Monsterverse movies as a bit of connective tissue. Clues lead them into the world of monsters and ultimately down the rabbit hole to Army Officer Lee Shaw, played by Kurt Russell and also Wyatt Russell, taking place in the 1950s and half a century later, where Monarch is threatened by what Shaw knows. The dramatic saga spanning three generations reveals buried secrets and the ways that epic earth-shattering events can reverberate through lives. So we're going to see Wyatt and Kurt Russell, obviously related, playing the same character in different time periods. So there will be flashbacks to the 1950s where Wyatt Russell will play this character, and in the present day we'll see Kurt Russell trying to deal with the aftermath of what happened in with the battle between Godzilla and the Titans. The series was co-developed by Chris Black, who worked on Star Trek Enterprise, and Matt Fraction, who worked on Hawkeye. And the first two episodes, so those that will be premiering in November, are directed by Matt Shackman, who was the mastermind behind WandaVision for Disney Plus. So there's teaser art, and if you're watching this podcast on YouTube, I will play the trailer for you now. If you're listening to this on either Apple, Spotify, or any other podcast platform, head over to our website where you can watch the full trailer. Just a reminder, that is Monarch Legacy of Monsters premiering globally with two episodes on Friday, November the 17th, 2023, and then running through to January the 12th, 2024. That's it for the news this week. If you want to pick up all the latest breaking stories, make sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on all platforms at Get Your Comic On. And if you want to pick up all of the latest stories, head to our website, www.getyourcomiccon.co.uk. Now, onto some reviews. So before we head into Comics Corner, I have two TV shows that I want to talk to you about. We're going to kick off with Star Trek Lower Decks, which returned last week as I am recording this podcast, with the first two episodes of Season 4. There are another 8 episodes which will stream weekly for the next few weeks. So I have seen 8 of the 10 episodes of the season. So I've seen the 2 which are already streaming and another 6. I have 2 more episodes to watch which I don't have yet because they're being kept kind of secretive. I'm going to keep this spoiler light as well because I don't want to ruin what's coming up. So we can talk a bit about the first 2 episodes, but just want to give you my general thoughts on Season 4 so far, which is that I love it. I mean, to be fair, you've heard us talk about Lower Decks on this podcast many, many times, and we are big fans of the show. Just to say, the usual cast are back. So Tawny Newsome, Jack Quaid, Noel Welsh, Eugene Cordero as the 4 leads, Dawn Lewis as Captain Carol Freeman, Jerry O'Connell as Jack Ransom. There is a... I was going to say a new character, but there was a character who we have seen before who makes a more permanent kind of return here. So Gabrielle Ruiz, who voices Vulcan Ensign T'Lyn. So she was seen in a previous episode where we visited the Lower Deckers on different species ships. And at the end of that episode, she was being forced to leave the Vulcan group and join Starfleet. So she is now serving aboard the USS Cerritos, and you will see her recurring throughout this season. The biggest thing for me about Season 4 is character development and also how it decides to make slightly different, more maybe evolved choices about how it uses its Easter eggs and its cameos this year. So the show has always had a reverence for classic Star Trek. You know, we've seen plenty of people turn up from other Trek shows, and even more than that, we've seen how much Lower Decks will poke fun at or kind of repeat or, you know, cover old ground from other Star Treks. And what Season 4 does is do that in a slightly... I was going to say a slightly more restrained manner. That's maybe not the exact right turn of phrase to use for it. It's a... as I said, I guess, it's a more evolved sensibility this season. The characters, and this is not a spoiler, our leads are getting a promotion this season. They're becoming lieutenant junior grades, which, as Boimler points out, is kind of the bottom rung of the middle of the ladder, as it were. So they're still lower deckers, but they're lower deckers with slightly more responsibility, and they no longer have to sleep in communal bunk beds. And that is kind of the first sign of Lower Decks really doubling down on its characters. And it's difficult to say without making it sound like it was a flaw before, which it wasn't. But if you think that the show had great characters and all of that kind of relentless poking fun at Star Trek, now we are saying that the characters are really able to carry the show by themselves. The rest of it is extra fun, but now we've spent enough time with these characters and the actors are so used to these roles that there is plenty within them that is able to carry a Star Trek show. It doesn't have to be the Star Trek show that pokes fun at other Star Trek, though we will talk about episode 1, 2, Vix, which very much does that. It you know, between Beckett and Brad and Tendi and Rutherford, they are so... I called him Brad. Boimler. Between them, they are really able to carry the narrative of this show at this point. And so the storytelling has evolved to a point where they are able to do that, and then everything else is the icing on top of the cake. So there is plenty that comes from seeing all 4 of them being promoted. Again, I'm hoping that you've all seen the first 2 episodes, because one of those promotions doesn't happen in the first one, it waits until the second one. But being promoted has an impact on each of them that then reverberates through the rest of the episodes that I've seen. So, you know, you're going to get to see how Beckett, you know, reacts to being promoted, which is something that's happened to her before. She's been promoted and demoted so many times we've lost count. Whereas for someone like Boimler, who is desperate to have that amazing career and to progress, there is a very unexpected reaction from him, which is really, really exciting to watch, because it unravels not how you would expect whatsoever. And then for Tendi and for Rutherford, there are different things going on that are around their promotion and what that means for their careers and how they will interact with each other and how they interact with other people. And it's really, really exciting to see that Lower Decks is affording them that level of character development at this point. Because with adult animation, if you think about something like The Simpsons or... South Park or Family Guy, whatever it might be, characters rarely age up. They rarely change jobs or move on. It's very much about the situation that they are in at the beginning and the weird things they get into. And that's what we've seen across the three seasons up to this point, is they've been ensigns on the same ship who have just fallen into and out of all these different misadventures. But now, you know, there are moments that you will see this season, like Boimler leading his first away team, and he has people that he is responsible for. You will see Beckett maybe thinking that actually her place is within Starfleet, and that actually there is room for her to grow. And so there is a real fleshing out of these characters in a way that allows Lower Decks to progress and to evolve, and allows its storytelling to become something slightly different this season, and that's very, very exciting. Another thing that they're doing this season that's quite new is introducing some serialized storytelling, which is maybe taking more of a leaf from, say, Strange New Worlds than Discovery. So with something like Discovery and Picard, we saw serialized seasons, and literally all 10, however many episodes, would be that story from start to finish with very, very small weekly elements. This is a slightly different approach. Like I say, it's a bit more reflective of what they do with Strange New Worlds, in that there are elements that dip in and out of this story throughout the season, and you're introduced to those in the first episode. And, you know, it's leading us towards a potential villain reveal for later in the season, which tells you something spoiler-wise that I said later in the season. It's not Lower Decks becoming some strange serialized show completely across the board. Everything is very much still an episode of the week, but there is an underlying storyline which will come to the fore towards the end, which is more heavily serialized. And that's also very exciting to see them just flexing the format of the show a little bit at this point, and saying, you know, we've proven that we should exist, we've proven that we belong within the Star Trek world, so now we're going to have some fun with it and do things a little bit differently and see how we go. So in these first two episodes, you do get two very different stories. The first is a massive Easter egg deep dive nod to Voyager. That's the episode called Tuvix. Hopefully you have all seen that by now. Again, it doesn't do the obvious things. There are not obvious cameos. There are cameos, but they're not the most obvious ones. And it's a different way of approaching it. It's approaching a Voyager story through how our guys interact with them, and how a story around Voyager might work with the Lower Decks cast in it. It's not a case of, here is a whole bunch of people from Voyager, let's just see what happens if we put them in animation and make it funny. And it works really, really well in that respect. And Voyager looks great in animation. I'm sure if you have watched it, you love the way that ship looks in animation. It looks great. I would love to see more of it. And I think it was probably the strongest season opener that they've done since the first ever episode of Lower Decks. It was a brilliant opener. It just hit the ground running. It was very funny. It was very Lower Decks. And it was just one of the most tightly written episodes that they have done. And funnily enough, it was written by showrunner Mike McMahon. So that kind of explains to me why it works so well, because it is, you know, the god of Lower Decks is the person who brought us this episode. And then you go into episode two, which has a lengthy title that I can't remember the name of, so I'm just going to look it up while I'm talking to you, which is very different in style. It's called I Have No Bones Yet I Must Flee, which is a play on words from previous Star Trek, and it's a very different type of episode. It starts to dig into how each of them reacts to their promotion, and really we get, well, so this the synopsis for it is Mariner tries to get demoted whilst Rutherford tries to get promoted, and Boimler makes a big move. And so there are different storylines going on. For Mariner, it's very much digging into her reaction. For Boimler, it's about the physical kind of immediate knee-jerk reaction to that promotion, and for Rutherford, it's let's get him promoted. So really, there are quite a lot of different things going on, and that leads me into something else I want to talk about, which is the pairings of characters. We'll get to that in just a sec. But it's very, very funny. You get a huge amount of comedy from Boimler just fumbling around, trying to figure out what to do, what his first move is. And you get a very different type of comedy with Mariner and Ransom on this space station museum, where they are faced with the now legendary Moopsie. Moopsie! I'm going to regret doing that. But yeah, that leads me into what I want to talk about with the pairings of characters. So if you've read my reviews of previous episodes of Lower Decks, I've talked about how there is a convention within the show that it is generally that thought of that the pairings will be Boimler and Mariner, Tendi and Rutherford. And every now and then, Marinette and Tendi will get paired up, and there is a wonderful episode later this season where that will happen. But what we see within the first two episodes of season four, and then throughout the season, is more experimentation with the pairings. It helps that you now have Tilin, who is also working in science, so is naturally just around Tendi a lot more. But you kind of also have Mariner pairing maybe a little bit more with Ransom. So the ensemble cast is coming into this a little bit more. And I don't mean that as in they're sharing the lead. They're just using them more wisely in story choices and making the kinds of character choices that mean that we get to see something slightly different. So with Tuvix, we get to see Boimler spending quite a bit of time with Rutherford, which is new. And here, it's again, it's a bit of a pairing of Boimler and Rutherford eventually, but it's for a while, Boimler is on his own, and Rutherford is doing his thing with Tendi, and Mariner is paired up with Jack Ransom. And so she's spending time with him at the Space Museum. So there are different pairings going on, and you will see a lot more of that throughout the season, and that's very, very exciting to see as well, because it just opens up more avenues for storytelling, different types of stories than what we've seen before. And it really does add up to what I think is the most consistent season of the show so far. I have enjoyed every single season, but this one feels like everyone is running on... everyone is on, like, Warp 9. It's a good Star Trek reference. But there's also just... you can feel the confidence in the show now. There is a confidence in the format. There is a confidence in the characters. There's a confidence in the actors, the writing. Every aspect of the show, you can now feel that everyone knows what they're doing. Everyone is comfortable what they're doing. And they're comfortable doing a little bit of experimentation with that to see how they can push it further. And that's really exciting to see, particularly for a show that was maybe written off in the early days by some, that has won plenty of fans over, but also a show that has been around for a few years now. It's not just resting on its laurels and doing what has made it popular. It is saying, we know what you enjoy about this show. How about we do this as well and see if you enjoy it even more? And that kind of experimentation, I think, is really, really welcome and is something that you will get to enjoy throughout the season. I don't want to spoil anything about what's coming up, but I'm going to say, watch out for episode 7. 7 is a great one. I think that's all I'll say. Yeah. I'm interested to see where the villain storyline goes. It's difficult to know from the bits and pieces that I've seen where it is going to go, but it's exciting to see that type of storytelling being explored with this idea that you get little nuggets of it throughout other episodes. But I haven't seen enough yet to know exactly where it's going. So if you want to read my full first impressions on season 4, then it is up on the website, so please go to the website and check that out. And I am kind of trying to do weekly sort of reviews of the individual episodes as well, because although I think the season as a whole really is wonderful and I gave 5 stars to Tuvix as the first episode, there are some specific moments and things that don't work for me as well, but is all still absolutely great. I mean, an average episode of Lower Decks is a great episode of plenty of other shows out there, so there is so much to enjoy. And I really, really can't wait to see where it lands. It's going to be very exciting to see where this season goes, knowing that there is a season 5 as well. I just wonder how much further they can push this, and that's very, very exciting to see. Have you watched the first 2 episodes? If you have, please do get in touch and let me know what you thought, because I'm interested to know how... I saw the first episode at the cinema on Friday on Star Trek Day, and it was fun to see it with a big audience because it looked great on the big screen, but also it was fun to see what things people connect with that maybe I don't, and it's just interesting to see what it looks like in a kind of wider group setting. So please do reach out and let me know if you've watched the episodes and what you thought, and keep watching Lower Decks as it streams new episodes on Paramount Plus every Thursday. And so the other show that I want to talk to you about is back today as we're launching this podcast, and that is Apple TV's The Morning Show. It stars Jennifer Aniston, Reese Witherspoon, Billy Crudup, Mark Duplass, Nesta Carbonell, Karen Pittman, Victoria Tate. I'm being careful because I don't want to spoil too much about anyone that might come into this season. This season you are joined by Jon Hamm, who is a new character that joins, and also Nicole Beharie, who fans of Sleepy Hollow from a few years ago. It's great to see her back on our screens. Season 3, I have seen all 10 episodes. 2 episodes are available as of right now as this podcast is releasing, and then new episodes will drop weekly for the next 8 weeks after that. This new season brings some new challenges, some new faces, some new challenges, and a whole new angle and aesthetic to the morning show that's really exciting to watch. This is by far its darkest season. It's by far its most challenging season, I think, as well, in terms of some of the things that it's tackling. And it's also the season where I have absolutely binged the whole thing in a matter of hours, because I just had to keep going episode after episode right through to the very, very end, which I have enjoyed seasons 1 and 2. I was really excited to see season 3. I now can't wait for season 4, because there is... I just don't know where this show goes next. This season, I'm going to be, again, obviously only 2 episodes are available and you've barely had a chance to watch them as I'm releasing this, so this is going to be very, very, very light in terms of spoilers, because I don't want to give anything away. Season 3 is a huge roller coaster. So you have this new character played by Jon Hamm that comes in very early on, who is he's an Elon Musk type character. He is a tech giant who is looking to potentially buy UBA. And so you have this specter looming over the season of this potential new owner. And it's very exciting. So his name's Paul Marx. Sorry, I did just have to look that up. And Paul owns a company that is very much like SpaceX. And he is looking to branch out and is looking to buy this legacy media company, in UBA. And that has ramifications for Alex, played by Jennifer Aniston, and Bradley, played by Reese Witherspoon, and everyone, the whole main cast. He has ties to Stella, played by the absolutely outstanding Greta Lee. So if you've not seen Past Lives yet, which is a film which is kind of doing the rounds at the moment, it is outstanding, and Greta is beyond Oscar worthy in it. And her performance in this season is really scene stealing as well. She is great in every moment. Stella really steps up this year, and it's just a sign of how many of these cast members have become so important to the writers and to their fans as well, that there are a lot of subplots going on for different people. So, you know, Alex and Bradley have their stuff going on. Corey has tons going on this season, which also brings in his mum, who you will meet this year. You know, Chip has things going on. Stella has stuff going on. Nicole Beharie's character, Christina, is a very interesting new addition, and I hope she will stick around for season 4, because it would be interesting to see where her character could go based on some of the things she does this season. Juliana Margulies is back as Laura Peterson. She has some very interesting stuff, not just with Bradley, but also with Alex and her own thing going on. Yanko, played by Nesta Carbonell, is kind of just par for the course. There are some interesting revelations with him that will come out this season, but he is very much a supporting player, where everyone else kind of has their moment as a lead. Mia, played by Karen Pittman, again, I mean, Mia has been really consistent throughout this whole show, but she has some new interesting stuff going on this year that is, again, very compelling to watch. And I've realised in watching this season what it is about The Morning Show that I think makes it really work and really pop, and that is the fact that it works in the past. So many shows like this either try and say that they're in the present day and emulate a kind of idea as to what's going on, or work in the future and try and guess what might happen next. And so you could make The Morning Show and set it now and say, you know, these are the fictional things that are happening now, or you could set it in a kind of unknown time period and just allude to things that could happen. You know, they could do a vague story about AI because that's a big deal, but what they proved last year with COVID was wait until after the fact, or nearly after the fact, wait until you're knee deep in the fact that you understand what's happening, and you can tell some really, really compelling stories where you can dive into what people have experienced and therefore they connect with it more. So to exploit the kind of big tech giant buys another company, immediately you start thinking about SpaceX and you start thinking about Elon Musk taking over, I'm not calling it that, Twitter. And that really, really speaks to the level of writing in this season. So there are so many aspects of the story, bringing in the Ukraine-Russia war and looking at that from all the information that we know about it now, is just really compelling to watch. And they really, I don't want to say exploit because that's not a great word to use, but they really really hone in on that. And this season, more than any other season, they play on things that are happening in Hollywood, things that are happening globally, things that are happening in tech and in media, and present them so well, so incredibly well. And it's another really well-acted season by the whole cast. You know, Jennifer Aniston is great, Reese Witherspoon is great, Billy Crudup really pushes Corey this season and takes him to some almost emotional breaking points, which are sad, heartbreaking to watch, but he plays them really, really well. You know, Chip still brings that kind of comedy relief that you need at certain moments where he turns up. Juliana Margulies gets some big emotional beats this season. John Hamm is interesting because he's a character who you could really fall for, but at the same time you're always slightly wary of him and what his real next move is. There's even a lot going on for Sybil, played by Holland Taylor. She has plenty this season, and they bring in the wonderful Tig Notaro as a guest role as she plays Amanda, who is kind of a fixer for Paul, John Hamm's character. So, you know, there's so much going on. It's a very, very busy season, but it's really tightly written and works. And once you kind of get a measure of where that storyline is going, it really carries you right through to the end, which is fantastic. They stick the landing on this season very, very well, to the point where actually when you get to the final scenes and the season finale, if you did not know or that there was already a season 4, you could quite happily presume that this was the end of the show. It would be an almost perfect ending if there wasn't another fantastic story on the horizon that they are able to tell going into another season. I really don't want to say too much more because I don't want to spoil it, but there are some twists and turns this year which I think you will struggle to see coming and are really, really fascinating and have made me slightly paranoid, but also at the same time just make this show really, really, I've said this word so many times in the last 5 minutes, but really compelling to watch. And it's great to see a TV show be that, I don't know what's the word, I've lost the power of speech. It's just, I don't want to say compelling again. It really grabs you and does not let go for the entire 10 episodes, which is great. You know, not many shows are able to do that at this point. And I think it's going to be the kind of scenario where some people will love the water cooler moments where you'll get to the end of an episode knowing you've got to wait a week for the next one. And it's going to be like, oh my God, how did it end there? Why did it, you know, this person has just made this huge move. How on earth do I have to wait a week? Whereas there will be other people that maybe will wait and binge the whole 10 episodes. And it's really rewarding in that respect because you can get through it and you will be holding your breath before you get to the end because it's just so compelling, a word I have not used that much this podcast. Do I want to pick up any other highlights? I don't want to say too much. Let's talk about both Alex and Bradley for a second. So for Alex, Jennifer Aniston's character, there is a search and a need to find her place in the company now that all the Mitch stuff is behind her, the COVID stuff is behind her. She's kind of in a position where she has some power within the company, and this season is about how she learns to use that power, which is really interesting to watch. But also her relationship with John Hamm's character, they have really wonderful chemistry, and with this kind of looming spectre of him wanting to buy the company, that sparks some interesting stuff between the two of them, which doesn't necessarily go to the most obvious places. Whereas with Bradley, kind of Bradley and Alex are almost separate this season. They obviously, you know, are ships in passing at UBA, but their friendship is explored more towards the end of the season. And particularly, I think, moving forwards, we will see a different dynamic between the two of them. But for Bradley herself, in the early episodes, you're kind of teased that something has happened in the year or so. It's kind of between a year or 2 years between seasons, and that's something which is teased out and could go in several different directions, and they do a really wonderful job of making you think that maybe it's going to go one way before it goes another. And when the revelation really comes as to what has happened to her between seasons, I actually at one point wondered whether they had written themselves into a corner with her character. And by the end of the season, I was glad that they had done what they did with her, but I'm interested to see what they're able to do next with it and how she is able to well, she's never going to return to a status quo, but how she's going to be able to get back to being a central point in the storyline, because it feels like she's moved slightly out of that by the end of this season. I think I've said too much. So it's really fascinating to see, because they're really swinging for the fences this season, and I think it's a home run. Sports reference. That's also new for this podcast. It is by far the best season of the show, which I think is great. Again, for both the shows that I have just talked about, they are really on top of their game this year, which is very, very exciting and makes for some absolutely great TV. Will you be watching The Morning Show Season 3? If so, get in touch, let me know. Let me know what you think of today's episodes once you've watched them. And definitely circle back to me once you get to the end, because wow. Wow. So I think now let's go over to Comics Corner and talk about some books. So this week in Comic Book Corner, I have a handful of books I want to talk to you about. Four books I want to talk to you about, which is very, very exciting. I have two DC books, one from Boom and one from Image. I'm going to kick off with the Boom Studios book, which is Buffy the Last Vampire Slayer. There are two issues of this book which are currently available in stores and on digital platforms. It is written by the lovely Casey Gilley. The illustrations are by Oriol Roig and Nicola Izzo. Colours by Gloria Martinelli and letters by Ed Dukeshire. Now, before I dive in, don't forget that I did chat with Casey Gilley at San Diego Comic Con. You can listen to that interview in a previous episode of the podcast, or you can watch it over on our YouTube channel as well. So please, please do check that out, because she is an incredible Buffy fan and an incredible writer as well. And it's a really, really fun interview, which I hope to circle back to in time for the end of this current run of Buffy the Last Vampire Slayer. So I'm going to keep it spoiler light for this book, but let's give you some context in case you've not read any of what's come before this. So Buffy the Last Vampire Slayer has been a miniseries and a special prior to this new series. It is set in an alternate future, so it's not necessarily the future of the actual TV series continuity, but this is a future where Buffy has certainly made it past her early 20s, where she was only ever expected to live to. She's now in her, I guess, 50s, and she is living in the fictitious California town of Santa Carmen. I think it's fictitious. Please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. She is now a watcher to the first Slayer who has existed in a very, very long time. Her name is Thessaly, otherwise known as Thess. She also happens to be the daughter of Willow and Tara, which is very exciting for fans of the TV series and of those particular characters. So Thess is currently the Slayer and is being mentored by Buffy, who no longer has the powers of a Slayer. Buffy is still with Spike in this version of the universe, and Anya is also hanging around in a very important part of this series. The story of this particular miniseries kicks off with Buffy and Spike trying to go on a little holiday, a little break, get some time away, decompress a bit, you know, as all parents need to when you've got an angry teenager at home. And so Anya has stepped in as the kind of makeshift watcher who is looking after Thess, who is doing all of the Slayer things that we would expect. She is patrolling, she's fighting vampires, she's dealing with some serious teenage hormones, and she just really wants to go on date night at this point. And the reason that I want to talk about this, so that I should say I have also reviewed this on the website. So if you head over to getyourcomiccon.co.uk and just search Buffy the Last Vampire Slayer, you can pick up my review of this. But the reason that I wanted to talk about it on this podcast is, what is the most remarkable thing about this? In years of Buffy comics that have existed either at the same time as the TV show or following the TV show, is being able to tap into what I think is the thing that made Buffy so great. There are many, many people who tuned into Buffy because they loved the horror and the fantasy and the demons and the action. And that is certainly the reason why I first watched it. But the thing that you dig into the minute that you start watching Buffy is the fact that there is always a strong emotional undercurrent that is the reason why the characters are so compelling. The reason that we all loved Buffy as a teenager, you know, when we were also teenagers, is that as we grow up with her, we see her going through the same kind of things that we went through. The difference is she's doing it and fighting monsters from hell, which, if you ask me, would have made my life far more interesting as a teenager. Yep. But there is that allegory between the fighting your demons, literally fighting your demons, and fighting your emotional demons and growing up. And what Casey has done here is just incredibly, massively, perfectly tap into that. It is This is exactly how I would expect a story about Buffy at this age to play out if it was on TV. The idea that she has lost her power, lost many of her friends. She is now this very solitary character, although she has reconnected with Spike and still has connections with Anya. But she has become a very, very solitary character who is, you know, she's not a hero of the world. She's not celebrated. There is no Buffy Day out there. She isn't, you know, she saved the world many, many, many times, but no one really cares. She just exists. And she is resigned to that, and she's resigned to the fact that she's lost her power, and she is now just doing the best job that she can in trying to raise Thessaly. And what Casey deals with in this story, and particularly kind of comes to it the fore in this issue, is that Buffy has never grieved losing her power. She's never grieved losing friends. She's never grieved even really maybe losing her mum, never mind everything else that she has lost over the years. And now to see this new Slayer wielding this power and kind of loving it, to be fair, is difficult for her. And that's really interesting because, firstly, I think that's a really brave story to tell. But secondly, it's also not the obvious story to tell. The obvious story to tell would be, you know, that there's been no vampires for ages and Buffy gets called back into action. Not Buffy is forced to confront everything that she was and isn't now. And how important is that as a story, I guess, for everyone, but certainly for women of a certain age? Because we, you know, you only have to look at the number of incredible actors in their 40s, 50s, beyond, who, particularly female actors, who talk about the fact that the interesting and the exciting roles kind of disappear. You don't become a lead. You're a leading lady in your 20s and 30s, and then you're expected to be the mum, the support, the you know, the aunt. And so there aren't enough stories out there that tackle that and tackle what it can be like to be in this world of men who take away your power and leave you with nothing. And so it's just very exciting to see and very exciting to read. And then at the same time, those of you who come to this book that want to see that melodramatic teenage action, it exists. It all exists there with Thessaly. She is angry. She is being smothered by Anya, who just wants to do a good job. And it's really fun to read. All of those aspects of Buffy that you would expect to be there exist in the Thessaly storyline. And all of the kind of unique and new stuff exists within the Buffy storyline. So it's going to be exciting to see where it goes, because this issue leads up to a very, very huge turning point at the very end. I'm not going to spoil it for you. But certainly there are things to come with Thess that I think could be very interesting. There are things to come with Anya which could be very interesting. And it's exciting to see what is happening with Buffy, because this is a very new story for her. And just outside of the story, it's also worth noting, so Ariel Roig, who is the kind of lead artist on this, has only really joined Buffy the Last Vampire Slayer in this miniseries. Prior to that, Casey had worked with Joe Jarrow on both the miniseries that kicked it off and also the special. So there is a new kind of visual aesthetic which has taken a little bit of adjusting to in this. But the thing that I just want to point out is that the natural kind of knee-jerk reaction, maybe not necessarily from Boom, because I think what Boom are doing with their IP books like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and Buffy is incredibly exciting across the board. But certainly there is a, and this is a sweeping statement, but there is a knee-jerk reaction to, with this kind of IP, just focus more on the visual and have the visual be as close to what you used to see on the TV screen or on the big screen. So if you look back at issues of Buffy from around the time the TV series were on, some of the artwork is less imaginative, it's less exciting, and it really just tries to say, oh look, there's Sarah Michelle Gellar on a page, there's Alison Hannigan, there's Emma Caulfield, there's James Masters. And that is not what Joe did in the early Buffy the Last Vampire Slayer books, and it is not what Oriole is doing here. I think you get a much more exciting book and your story is able to breathe a lot more when you aren't literally just trying to tell me that I'm looking at a version of Sarah Michelle Gellar. The way that these characters are rendered on the page is recognisable to who they are as a character, not who they were as an actor. if that makes sense. So when I look at the page, I know who Buffy is. I can see Buffy. I can, you know, her body movements, her facial expressions, her actions are very much her. If you look at someone like Spike, the key characteristic is obviously the hair, and the hair exists. And so there are the elements there that you would expect that make sure you know who they are, but there is no kind of... there is no dedication to telling me that this is James Masters and it's Sarah Michelle Gellar and that really we just want you to see that and that's why we want you to buy the book. All of the effort is going into making this a great book in every respect. And for that, I absolutely applaud it, which is why I highly recommend that you go and check it out, because I could talk about this for a very long time. So that's issue 2 of Buffy the Last Vampire Slayer, available now, as well as obviously issue 1 in print and on digital, where all good comic books are sold. And don't let me, you know, don't be under any misunderstanding that we're not going to cover the rest of this series, because we are. And I will be fighting to get Casey on here to talk about what I think could be a very exciting conclusion to this latest miniseries. Now, you're about to see me talk about Batman Gargoyle of Gotham, which I recorded thinking that the book was going to come out on the 12th. And I'm releasing this podcast on the 13th. What I had forgotten is that Gargoyle of Gotham is releasing on Batman Day, which is Saturday the 16th. So ignore me when I say it's out now, and remember that it's out on Saturday. So go buy it on Saturday on Batman Day. Celebrate Batman Day. Buy a great book. Now, I did promise that we would talk more about Batman Gargoyle of Gotham once it was available, and Batman Gargoyle of Gotham Book 1 released in comic book stores and on digital platforms yesterday. In case for some reason you haven't caught that I've been talking about this a lot, this is written and has artwork by Rafael Grampa. It has colours by Mateus Lopez, letters by John Workman. Rafael did also do the main cover art. And before we dive into it, he is somebody else who I spoke to at San Diego Comic Con. So yes, please do go back to the episode where you can listen to our interview or watch it over on YouTube if you haven't already heard it, because it is very interesting to see how he approached this book. I obviously went into this last episode and sort of danced around the spoilers a bit. I don't want to go heavily into spoilers, but the thing that I want to talk about now that you guys have probably had a chance to read this is just how much I think Raphael has really, really struck deep to who Batman as a character is, and really honed in on a very interesting personality trait and blown that up into the premise that is Gargoyle of Gotham. Obviously, we've only got one issue to go on so far, but this idea of Batman being the dominating personality and being so dedicated to the mission that he is unraveling the Bruce Wayne persona is really interesting to me. I totally understand why that isn't something that could exist in the kind of main Dawn of DC type continuity that of DC's books. I think you can see a little bit of it in what Ram V is doing with Detective Comics, but when you look at the main kind of DC overarching continuity, you have to temper some of who those characters are just so that they can fit in with the wider storytelling kind of aspects that are going on. So maybe if you look at the Gotham War event that Chip Zdarsky and Teenie Howard are unraveling right now, that is a very Batman-focused story, and therefore he is able to be a little bit more like this. But if he was to turn up in a Justice League book right now, or to dip into a Titans book, there are story reasons why he would need to be a slightly different version of the character that wouldn't necessarily be doing this. And that's why I think the kind of DC Black Label banner that this is under really allows Raphael to dig in to what it is that he finds interesting and exciting about the character and really give it the context and the development that it needs to be a very interesting story. So I think if you look at Batman on film, maybe not necessarily Michael Keaton, very much the Christian Bale and very, very, very much the Robert Pattinson versions of the characters reflect some of what Raphael is doing here. I think probably Robert Pattinson's the closest, but if you look at both Bale and Pattinson, you know, Bale was so dedicated to the mission that he asked Rachel to wait for him, which in many respects is a really crap thing to do. Like, I love you, I want to be with you, however, I have this thing to do first, so I'm going to expect you to just sit around and wait for me. Or in, that's a very selfish way to approach it. If you look at Pattinson's version, it's not selfish, it's just single-minded. And although he is obviously neglecting things like Wayne Enterprises, it's not that he's asking them to wait for him or anything like that. He just literally doesn't care, because all he cares about is fixing the city that has done these things to him that he has grown up in. And that is a version of the character that Raphael has really dug into. And that is the basis of this issue, is laying that groundwork for understanding that Bruce Wayne means nothing to him, literally nothing to him, and that really all he wants to do and all he cares about here is fixing this city. I don't want to dive into it anymore because I will end up spoiling the whole thing, but please, 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 now that it is out, go and grab your copy of Gargoyle of Gotham, because it is one of the best series that DC has put out this year. And I'm saying that after only having read one book. It's so good. It's so good. And it is in stores now. Please go buy it. And let me know what you think. There are two versions available. There is a noir edition and the main edition. So the main edition is in full colour. The noir edition has no colour in it whatsoever. It's black and white. I haven't spent much time with the noir edition yet. But if you are someone who has been reading what Image has been doing, going back into The Walking Dead and now releasing it in full colour, I think you get very different focal points when you read something in black and white to what you get when you see it in colour, particularly something that has a lot of colour in it and a lot of nuance that comes from the colour. So it's interesting to see what you might take from the noir version of Gargoyle of Gotham compared to the normal version. But if you have read it, I would love to know what you think. So please do find me on social media. I'm at Neil Vag on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, all of those things. And let me know what you thought of it, because I want to know how this book is going down out there with fans. I think you're going to love it, and I hope you're going to love it. And we'll be covering much more of it in the future. And guess what? I'm going to talk about another Batman book right now, because there is another number one in the Bat Universe that is available in comic book stores from yesterday, as you're watching or listening to this, and that is Batman and Robin number one, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Simone DeMayo, letters by Steve Wands, and main cover by Simone DeMayo as well. And this is a wonderful return for the team of Bruce and Damian. So they have been through it this last couple of years. We have had Batman versus Robin, we have had Lazarus Planet, we have had Dark Crisis, we have had Night Terrors, and now Gotham War obviously unraveling at the same time. And finally, we have a Batman and Robin book back, he says, swigging some tea. And this is classic Joshua Williamson. If you look at what Williamson has done with the Superman book and now with this book, they are very classic, but I say that kind of tentatively. It's not like I'm reading a story that should have been written in the 1950s. I mean, it is a more classically styled adventure for the characters, but still is very contemporary in its kind of thematical elements, if that makes sense. I am not going to spoil this because it's very exciting, and obviously I've only read one issue and it has only been in stores for 24 hours, so it would be unfair of me to spoil it for you. But it's just bringing back the idea of the fun team-up adventure. The Batman and Robin kind of legacy and mythos is that kind of more action adventure style. If you go back to the TV series, you go back to the classic Batman and Robin comics, you look at the golden eras of Batman and Robin, it is about not father and son in this case, but it is about hero and sidekick out there solving crime, saving the world. And that is very much what this is about. It's a simple action adventure return to form for these two characters. I think after a lot of very dark storytelling, it's time to have something a little bit more fun. The dawn of DC era is something a little bit more colourful. It obviously has a lot going on with Amanda Waller and what she's doing behind the scenes, but a lot of what DC is doing in its main books is bringing a bit more of the fun aspect back, and this is very much that. There are some really cool elements in here that I can't wait for people to see, like the beast 4x4 Robin mobile that he is driving around in. And that's actually something that I think is really important to talk about as well, that Williamson is doing with these kind of classically styled stories. He's working with some really incredible artists. So on Superman, it's Jamal Campbell. Here on Batman and Robin, it's Simone DeMeo. And it's like reading a story that is timeless, in that you could have pulled it from any kind of era and it fits that classic aesthetic of Batman and Robin. But the artwork is really sharp and contemporary and new and different and fun. It doesn't look like a comic book that could be pulled from any era. It doesn't, at this particular moment in time, look like a comic book that you could point at and say, okay, I know exactly which era that's from. It's new and exciting, and Simone DeMeo's artwork is so cool. It's razor sharp, and there are some awesome splash pages in this book that I immediately want to just tear out and put on my wall, particularly a shot of the two of them together that kind of evokes the cover, and the final shot of Batman with the hugely teasing to be continued in Bat versus Man, which might give away some of what the story could be, I suppose. But again, I don't want to say too much because I'm going to spoil it, but beautiful artwork, brilliantly written story. Great to have Bruce and Damian together, father and son, fighting crime once again. And I think it's ushering in a fun new era for the dynamic duo. So great to have them back, available in comic book stores and on digital platforms as we speak. Go buy it. Okay, so this last one is for the horror fans out there. If you've listen to this podcast or you've read some of my reviews, you know that I am a big horror fan, and I'm very excited that today in comic book stores and again on digital platforms we get the return of Image Comics Creepshow for volume 2. Now I'm sure you don't need me to tell you what Creepshow is. It is a very, very classic horror show from days gone by, in which you get multiple stories from different kind of directors, different writers, different acting, different creative teams that both tell a horror story with a twist, normally something moralistic, something fun, something creepy, something really twisted. And it was, what's the word I'm looking for? It was revived by Shudder a few years ago, and season 4 is actually starting next month. I just started digging in on review screeners for season 4, and it's under embargo, but let me tell you that season 4 is so much fun. And it's just, it's this really cool mid to low budget grassroots horror. It's just really twisted ideas, but with a reason and a kind of moral center that challenges some of your thought processes as you watch it, or in this case as you read it. So Image Comics has been publishing comics for a little while based on the Creepshow brand. It has been away for a little while, but it's back now with volume 2, issue number 1, which features two stories: Make Your Choice, which is written by Garth Ennis. It has art by the wonderful Becky Cloonan. It has colours by Lee Lockridge and letters by Pat Brosso, who also letters the second story, which is called Fossil Record. That one is written and penciled by Phil Hester, has inks by Eric Gapster and colours by Mike Spicer. There is also a bunch of very, very cool covers. Let me read you these names. So cover artists on this issue are Gwilym March, Becky Cloonan, Skinner, Alan Quarr, Brian Silverbacks and Sean Lee, that's together, Deegan Puchkors, Matt Wilson and Chad J. Keith. So again, this book, as you are watching or listening to this podcast, is literally just available. So I doubt you've had a chance to read this yet, so I'm not going to spoil it too much. But Make Your Choice, the first of the two stories, is brilliant. It is classic Creepshow. There is a weird creature. There's a very kind of, I'm not going to call it claustrophobic because it's not quite that tight, but there is, it's kind of a one location, low scale story that has a really huge emotional impact and also a very, very clever moral message behind it, which politically is very, very important, and is, it just typifies everything that Creepshow is. It is horror, it is gross, but it has a message, and that message is important. And there's nothing more exciting to me than being able to tell a horror story that I'm kind of looking at it and going, creature design is awesome, effects are awesome, story is awesome. Oh yeah, you made me think at the same time. And that is everything that Garth Ennis has been able to do in this story. It's kind of the bulk of this book. It's the longer of the two. It tends to be a case that there's sort of an A story and a B story. So this A story is very interesting. And I think there will be members of the audience that will find this very uncomfortable, but for the right reason. And the artwork is really able to help drive that point home. I'm just flicking through the pages in front of me as I'm recording this, and it's a bold choice to tell this story, but I absolutely understand why they've done it. And that's what I think makes both the show and this comic book very, very exciting, is that there are no holds barred in terms of what they're able to do and what they want to do and what they're going to do. And that follows through into second story, Fossil Record, which is more of a classic kind of creature feature. The artwork leads maybe a little bit more than the story in this second one, but it's a very, very cool read that kind of picks you up from the emotional turmoil of that first story. It picks you up and reminds you that whilst at the same time this book is able to be political and it is able to be thought-provoking, that it is also just able to do pure horror, and that's what that second one is. And that's a very important thing with this, is there has to be a balance between not being too heavy-handed in the message that it's trying to bring to you, but at the same time still making you think, still pushing the boundary, and still just creeping you out in the way that the TV show used to when it was first on the air, and whilst it does now on Shudder. I think that's all I want to say about this. If you are a horror fan and you're not reading this, then I highly recommend that you go and check it out. If you haven't watched the show, I also recommend you pick up a Shudder subscription and start watching it right now. But if you are a fan of... how do I want to put it? If you are a fan of thought-provoking, visceral horror experiences, then this is absolutely something that you are going to want to get involved with. So please do go and check it out, and I will circle back on future issues of it. They're in the style of a very, very classic comic book. There are adverts for what is to come in here. You could almost imagine picking this up as a kid and it being the kind of book that would have the advert for the specs that are, you can't quite see the book, but it's on the shelf behind me, just over there. You know, that kind of old school American pulpy comic book that has the adverts for like sea monkeys and stuff in the back that you phone up and then it arrives in the post like 6 months later, kind of thing. So keep on creeping on with Creepshow, which returns next month with two new stomach churning stories, which are called The Man with No Eyes. Looking forward to that. And Keep It Down, which could probably be very, very stomach churning. Available on October the 11th in comic book shops everywhere. So you get this nice tease for what is to come. And that, I'm going to leave it there. Please do let me know if you're reading Creepshow or if you're excited for the return for season 4. There is a season 4 trailer as well, which you can check out over on the website. So please do go watch that, because it's fun to see. I mean, horror is having a bit of a resurgence at the moment as it is, but it's just fun to see horror being horror for the sake of it and surprising its audience with elevated storytelling, because that's exactly what we need, I think, in this day and age. And I think the genre is keeping up with what it should be doing very, very well. And that is it for this podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Whether you watch us on YouTube, listen to us on Apple, Spotify, thank you very much. Please do make sure to like, subscribe, follow, leave reviews if you enjoyed it. That is. And I will be back in 2 weeks' time, where we will have celebrated Batman Day. I will bring you all of the excitement of the Batman Unmasked live exhibit experience, which is happening in London from the 15th to the 17th of September. And we will also have... I don't know. I actually don't know what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. I will have to have a think about it and keep it a surprise. But for now, enjoy the morning show. Enjoy the next few episodes of Star Trek Lower Decks as that continues to release season 4. Stay safe, stay well, and I will see you very soon. Bye! That's it for this podcast. Thank you very much. Whether you watched us on YouTube, listen to us on Apple or Spotify or another platform, please do make sure to like and subscribe. Leave us a review if you really enjoyed this episode. And I will be back in a couple of weeks' time, by which time I will have attended the Batman Unmasked live exhibit, which is opening in London and running from the 15th of September through to the 17th in celebration of this year's Batman Day. I actually don't know what else is going on over the next couple of weeks, so I'm going to have to sit back and have a think about it. But I'm certainly enjoying bringing you lots of comic book content, so I can't wait for you to see what I have to talk about next. In the meantime, enjoy the morning show, which premiered today. Let me know what you thought. Enjoy the next couple of episodes of Star Trek Lower Decks. You've got some interesting stuff to come as the season's kind of overarching villain continues to reveal itself. And I will see you very, very soon. Make sure to check out all of the latest news and reviews over on our website. I've told you enough times, but it's www.gateyourcomiccon.co.uk. And I will see you in a couple of weeks. Make sure and tune in to Luke and Nick next week as... No, you see, you fucked it up. That is it for this episode of the Get Your Comic Con podcast. Thank you very much for watching. If you're on YouTube or listening to us on whichever platform you're currently listening to us, make sure to like and subscribe and leave us a review if you really enjoyed this episode. I will see you in a couple of weeks, by which time I will have attended the Batman Unmasked live exhibit, which is opening in London on September the 15th and running through to the 17th. That is part of the Batman Day celebrations. You can read all about all of the global events that Warner Brothers and DC are running over on our website. I don't know what else is happening in the next couple of weeks. My mind has gone completely blank. I don't know if I have any films coming up or if we're in a slight lull before spooky season kicks in, which is very, very exciting to say the least. So, until next time, enjoy the next couple of episodes of Star Trek Lower Decks. You've got some fun stuff coming up there. Enjoy today's season premiere of The Morning Show on Apple TV and make sure to let me know what you think if you're really enjoying this season. And tune in next week when Nick and Luke will be back to dive into episode 3 of Daredevil season 1 as part of their deep dive season on the Consistently OK podcast. So until then, stay safe, stay well, and I will see you out there. Bye.